Last Sunday, we celebrated Easter, or at least the Christian churches of the Western world celebrated Easter, the resurrection of Jesus. Not to be conforming with our ideals, the Eastern churches are celebrating Easter today. I'm always interested in Easter. I loved Easter when I was a child because I spent a lot of my Easter holidays with my grandfather in West Cork. But I was always puzzled by how could the rather grisly execution of a dissident in a far corner of the Roman Empire be the start of something that has influenced practically the whole world. It has become a global religion, stretched out even to influence our lives here on a small rock that was never part of the Western Roman Empire. How did it happen? I mean, I'm not going to discuss whether Jesus existed or not, whether he was a real person or whether it's a myth. That's a story for a much longer discussion and perhaps more learned discussion. How Christianity spread seems to have been that small Christian churches grew up on the fringes of Jewish congregations. And we know from early times that there were quite a few of these churches, because the earliest writings in our New Testament scriptures are Paul's letters to the various groups he was, interfering with, that he was giving them advice and telling them how they should live their lives. So there was a church, there were Christians in Thessaloniki because he wrote the letters to the Thessalonians went there. There was a church in Galicia where the letters to the Galatians wended its way. There was a church in Corinth where they were blessed with two letters from Paul. There was a church in Rome and a church in Ephesus, and a church, obviously, in Jerusalem. Jerusalem looked as if it could be the dominant church for a while, because after all, this is where Jesus had actually walked, if he walked, and where his brother had taken up the reins of the sect that he had founded, that had founded around him. For a long time, it didn't seem clear as to which would be the dominant church. I mean, there were always infights and outfights and who's bigger than whom and who's more important than whom and whose patriarch is bigger or more powerful or works more miracles. And this carried on for a while. In the end, it was the church in Rome that dominated. They claimed that their first bishop was Peter, who had been commissioned by Jesus personally to lead this nascent religious group. Now, Rome was the capital of an empire, and it was a difficult and dangerous place to live. This early Christian church had to make accommodations with the Roman authorities. And I am of the opinion, which you do not have to accept, but perhaps hear me out, that these accommodations have been with us since. The first accommodation that the Christians had to make with the Romans was they had noticed that their Jewish brothers and cousins had come to an arrangement with the Romans that they had to pass on worshipping the gods of the Roman pantheon. They had come to an agreement that they had a limited form of religious freedom, and the Christians wanted this. So the Christians had to persuade the Romans that they were really a jazzed-up version of Judaism. They were a Jewish religion 2.1 or 2.5 or even Judaism 3.0. Now, the consequence of this was that they claimed ancestry back to Adam and through the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, even Noah was included, and Naomi, and a whole lot of other biblical characters. They claimed that Jesus was their descendant, their heir. This was, I think, a mistake because it soured relationships with the Jewish congregations for a long time. If you have to prove you're better than your neighbor, it makes it very hard to live on good terms with him or her. If you have to be constantly proving my version is better and yours are out of date, ridiculous, nonsense, even though they're practically the same as what I'm believing myself. It does make life difficult. Then the other accommodation that had to be made with the Roman imperial political status quo was, it's believed that the Romans were very, very leery of innovation. They hated new ideas, they didn't want new politics, they didn't want new religions. Everything that was to be accepted or acceptable to the Romans had to be old. Hence the old scriptures, the old way of doing things. And I think this has carried on in Christian tradition since that. There seems to be a determined effort to say that old is wonderful, old is the best, old is the way we're going to do it, even when it is blatantly no longer true, but we still say we'll do it the old way. Yes, we know that the new ways are better and they're more efficient and they're more life-affirming, but no, we're having nothing at all to do with new ideas, new ways of doing things. Now, even though I've called my address Choosing Your Path, I am aware that there are none of us here who are actually choosing a religious path. We live in a society where we've all been on a path from the word go, and we're all making choices, making decisions. What I'm hoping to do today is to point out where there may be some bare pits on the path, where there may be obstacles that you possibly haven't noticed before and that you might choose to avoid. From the earliest Christian times, some of the earliest exemplars of Christian living were the Desert Fathers. In later times, we have added the Desert Mothers because we must be politically correct. So we have Desert Fathers and Desert Mothers. They seem to have been quite strange people who, to escape their problems, to find God, they went out into the desert and lived lives of poverty, celibacy, and obedience. And since that time, poverty, celibacy, and obedience have been held up as the way to find God. Now, I'm not against these ideas. If anyone feels inspired by the thought of poverty, celibacy, and obedience, don't say that I told you not to do it. It inspired a lot of good Christians over the years. For me, these ideas just don't work. What I think we should do with the ideas of poverty, celibacy, and obedience is we should wrap them carefully in bubble wrap, put them in an old shoebox, tie it with string, and put it either in the farthest, darkest corner of the attic or put it in the basement of a nearby museum where they won't bother anyone ever again. If you think about it, I mean, look, poverty. Who in their right mind would advocate poverty as a way of living? Poverty is dreadful. Poverty is a curse. It's a shame on all of us that poverty exists in our city, in our country, in our continent, in our world. Poverty is something that should be wiped out wherever it happens. People who are poor, their lives are stunted. They're physically, emotionally, socially, their lives are a struggle. They die earlier. Life is just really hard for people who are in poverty. Nobody sensible would ever embrace poverty. It's not the way to be. Now, the other side of that is we have to have overindulgence is probably a bad idea. We all know that if we load ourselves down with possessions, stuff, our life, it sucks the magic, it sucks the energy out of our lives. In my own case, I was thinking about this during the week. I was recently in France for a weekend. And one of the days, myself and my friend went around to a cafe on the street and for 11s. And I had a glass of wine, and the glass of wine was 3.60. And I thought, wonderful, I'm loving this. This is really the way to live. But then when I got back to expensive cold Dublin, I thought to myself, oh, if I had a cafe around the corner from my house and I could get a glass of wine at 10:30 in the morning for 3.60, how long would my liver survive? Sadly, I think I'd be dead by the end of the year. When it comes to celibacy, I'm not anti-celibacy. Some people live celibate lives because that's their choice or because that is the life they have been given. And I'm not casting aspersions on people whose lives are, who choose that way of life or who have that way of life thrown to them, dealt to them. But people were not meant to live celibate lives, I think. I mean, we were made to live in intimate relationships with people for some of our lives at any rate. And the big objection I have to celibacy myself is that choose the way of life you want. But for heaven's sake, don't listen to me just because I'm standing in the pulpit looking at you and saying celibacy is a great idea. And I'm shaking my head when I'm saying celibacy is a great idea. So choose the way you want to arrange your personal life. Make a choice. You can't have too many friends. You can't have too many people in your life. Human beings were not meant to live solitary, hermit-like lives. Then the third one is obedience. I think obedience is the worst of the lot. Obedience is something that it should be the first to be thrown out. I mean, look, there was a report recently about a scandal involving the Irish Army. This is an organisation where obedience is seen as a hugely important, it's part of what army life is all about. But it's a disaster. It would do none of us any good if people obeyed every single suggestion, thought that came out of our heads. I mean, we don't turn into monsters in very quick time if the people around us obeyed every slight nod. It's not a way to live. And certainly after the experiences of the 20th century, having seen the transcripts of the Nuremberg trials, after Nuremberg, can anyone really say that obedience is a good idea? We should encourage people and we should lead by ourselves making choices, by questioning things. You don't have to argue about every single thing every day, but we all know when something is wrong. And we should teach our younger people and ourselves to say no when no is required. Mindless obedience is horrendous. Okay, now I have thrown out poverty, celibacy, and obedience. Am I going to replace them with something? Well, actually, no. I think that we should. Three seems to be a magic number in the context of religious virtues. We should have three things that guide our spiritual journey. And perhaps because we are living, breathing beings, instead of describing or holding up as ideals three outdated adjectives, we should replace them with three verbs. I mean, life is for living, so we should have a verb for each of these, possibly starting with observe. Look at the world around you. I mean, really look. Start with yourself. I mean, it's sometimes shocking if you just take a moment to look at ask yourself perhaps, how is the life I'm living affecting me? What's it doing to me physically, spiritually, psychologically? Are there things I should do more of or do less of for my own benefit? And then expand the circle. How is the way I'm living affecting the people around me? The people in my community, the people in the house with me, the people who live on the same street, the people who live in the city, the people who live in the wider community of the country, the wider global community. So start centrally with yourself and then expand. See what's going on. It's the same thing with relationships. One of the difficulties I have always felt with traditional Christianity is that it's very concerned with my salvation, my soul. And then the extension of that is family values. God preserve us from family values. I mean, we need families and we need to look after our families. But my definition of the ideal family, if I were to inflict it on half of you here, you'd be shocked and you'd say, oh, here, have it back. It's not working for me. I don't want to live like that. We should find ways to include the people around us so that our lives are enriched by people who are different from us. And this is becoming increasingly difficult because, especially as social media become more how we get our news and how we get our information, we are increasingly falling into bubbles. So every now and again, perhaps, listen to Fox News, watch Al Jazeera, see what is going on out there, see what different age groups, different ethnic groups are thinking, doing, and try not to say, God, they're awful, these people are dreadful. Accept that these are people that we could be ourselves. I mean, if we had been born in a different time, a different gender, different circumstances, maybe I could be somebody like that. When it comes to obedience, I think that this is a difficult one because you're walking a line between total chaos and total rigidity. I mean, you can't just drive anywhere on the road because nobody gets home ever. But common sense and consensus, and take longer for decisions, political, economic, or environmental, to be made. So when having thrown out poverty, celibacy, and obedience, replace them with a verb. Now, let's go back to the Old Testament scriptures. The Old Testament scriptures have been twisted by Christianity. They've been looked at as Jesus's backstory. It even bleeds into the New Testament. The first gospel in your standard New Testament is Matthew's gospel. And there's a huge chunk of genealogies there to prove that Jesus was related to King David, to the patriarchs, to probably Noah, and then back to Adam. This was not what the Old Testament was meant to do, or the Hebrew Scriptures. The Hebrew Scriptures were an attempt by an opinionated, difficult, contrary people to make a society where they could flourish and where they could survive. So read the Old Testament scriptures, but not to find out something about Jesus or what he was intending or what his mission. It was never designed to that. Leave that idea aside. Look at it as a struggle to find a way of building a society where that is inclusive, just, and sustainable. There are 317 odd rules in the Old Testament. Read these with interest, but then pop them into the same bin as you have popped all the other unnecessary, dead, moribund ideas. And think about writing. If you were to write rules for a just, fair, peaceful society that would have a place for every single person, the men and the women and the children and the transgender, artists and engineers and songwriters and chefs, gardeners and dog trainers, if you include a really wide spectrum of people, start writing the list and see how you go. And if you get beyond 12, well done. If you get to 317, please come back and share them all. I'd love to hear them. So on your path to finding a just, fair, peaceful society, have no hesitation in throwing out the old ways of doing things that no longer work. Perhaps cast an eye over them. Maybe some of them are worth keeping, but it's most unlikely. Listen to the people around you and have a whole lot of fun on the path through life. Life is so much easier and lighter when you throw down these burdens that we've been carrying as Christians of a sort for far too long. Have a wonderful life. Amen.